Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Vegan, psychologist, along with my co-host, Shelley Visconti, counselor and marriage and family therapist. This evening, we're focusing on domestic violence, which is prompted by the recent high-profile cases of domestic violence recently in the media. And of course, as many of you know, this is Domestic Violence Awareness Month here in our area and perhaps elsewhere. This evening, we have as our guest Ms. Patrina Jenkins, community educator and outreach coordinator for Project Celebration, as well as Sergeant Lindsay Bonner of the Shreveport Police Department's Domestic Violence Unit. Ms. Jenkins, Sergeant Bonner, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Glad to have both of you here. Again, we invite all of our listeners to call in with their comments and questions. Our number here at Red River Radio is 1-800-552-8502. Ms. Jenkins, let me begin by just asking you to tell us a little bit about Project Celebration and the services that your organization provides. Could you
Sure.
do that?
Sure. Project Celebration, we do domestic violence services as well as sexual assault services for women and children who have been abused. Our services include a 24-hour emergency shelter as well as community outreach education. We assist with safety planning. We have support groups for both women and children, all advocacy-based, all trauma-informed care. We also do children's advocacy and legal and court advocacy, and we have rural outreach as well.
Well, okay, very good. So if you're one of our listeners and you have questions for Ms. Jenkins and you want to know more about Project Celebration, please feel free to call in and she'll be available. Sergeant Bonner, you and I met about 20 years ago when you became an officer and I was working with the police department selecting new officers.
Yes, sir.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
You have been with the Shreveport Police Department's Domestic Violence Unit. Would you tell us and our listeners a little bit about your work and about the police department's unit?
Yes, our unit consists of four altogether, myself as the investigator supervisor, and I have three corporal detectives under me. Our procedures that we usually do, we provide a continuum services, both legal and advocacy assistance to victims of domestic abuse. We conduct misdemeanor criminal investigations between adults concerning reported domestic violence and of intimate partners. We coordinate with the city and parish courts to prosecute repeat violent offenders of domestic violence. We coordinate with the Cattle Parish and Bossier Domestic Violence Task Force for Louisiana Coalitions of Violence Against Women on domestic abuse, violence issues, and training and laws. And we also provide whatever advocacy information that a victim or a suspect may need in reference to any of the cases. And we coordinate any needed requested domestic violence training with the Shreveport Police Regional Academy. And we also speak in forums or discussion groups like tonight.
Well, thank you both for being here. You know, years ago, and this is meant to be a conversation among all of us, Shelley, myself, and the two of you. And so please feel free to interrupt or add or subtract as we kind of go along.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you right now.
Go ahead.
I'd like to invite our listeners to give us a call and join the conversation at 1-800-552-8502.
Well, thank you. Let me ask both of you, how pervasive is domestic violence? Do you have some ideas about that from your perspectives?
Well, it crosses all social and economic backgrounds through different parties. So due to the amount of people that are affected by domestic violence, it crosses everywhere. It isn't specific just for one group, not economically or racial or where a certain party resides. So it's actually like when you look at certain groups, say, in the sporting community, and we see how these national incidents occur, and it appears as if that is very dominant in that field when actually the numbers are pretty much equal to what we're encountering with the rest of society. So it's a reflection of what we actually have in all throughout society. And those national cases have actually helped for a dialogue with, you know, the rest of the country. So it's made people to try to begin to speak on a situation that most people have kept privately. The statistics that, you know, we could go on and on about here tonight, and we're going to go over some of them later on. But most of these cases are underreported, whether it's the female that's the victim, or we have cases where males are victims, but they're underreported. But the stats that we do have are so great for the amount of cases that are reported. You would wonder, you know, just for that small amount, if everybody reported, you know, we couldn't even compute most of the abuse that actually goes on within this country.
Why are they underreported, do you think?
Out of fear. It takes approximately maybe about 8 incidents thereabout before the first call is even made from that particular victim. Now, if you have other parties that live within the area that actually see abuse going on, they'll call most of the time prior to that victim wanting to actually make a call to the police. So it's out of fear. It's that fear, and the basic definition of domestic abuse is about power and control, you know, from that one intimate partner upon the other. And they utilize different avenues of control upon that victim. They isolate them. They get them away from family members and friends. And all those things, you know, play into the effects that's being weighed upon that victim. So they're out of fear. And then also, and I often use this in some of the classes that I teach, especially other officers. And when the victim first goes out with the offender and they meet and they're dating, you know, that offender, when they're out having steak, doesn't reach across the table and just slap that victim that first date. You know, it's a romance, and they sweep them off their feet and they fall in love with each other. That victim falls in love with this individual. So it's difficult for them to just fall out of love. And even though all this abuse is going on, they think this person will change. They want to keep giving them the benefit of the doubt. So
of course, what you're saying is most of the abuse is in secret.
Yes.
We don't generally abuse people in public. So it's a secret. And then from a psychologist's point of view, in my experience with particularly women who have been battered, they use the defense mechanisms of minimization.
Exactly.
And denial and so on. But Trina, did you want to speak on this issue?
Sure.
Of pervasiveness from your point of view?
Sure. Statistically, 1 in every 4 women report that they've been physically assaulted by an intimate partner between the ages of 15 and 55. And every 12 seconds, a woman is battered in the United States by an intimate partner. In this country, an average of 4 women are killed a day by an intimate partner. So definitely domestic violence is prevalent. And I think the question that we all have and usually come into contact with is, why doesn't she just leave? And as Sergeant Bonner tapped on somewhat about, we have to look at the systems around keeping her at bay to the violence, so to speak, because we've got to look at her church family. We've got to look at the education system and, of course, financial. And you're looking at a woman who loves this person. Mm-hmm. And she has hope. She's hopeful that he's not the person that he's become, that he is the person that she went out to dinner with. She wants him to be that person. So there's a huge amount of hope that's still there in combination with fear, as Detective Bonner said.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that, you know, people that enter intimate relationships are attracted to one another, and they do build a relationship, and it is based on love and commitment and so on. Our listeners, again, we invite you to call in 1-800-552-8502 if you have questions and comments. Our program tonight probably will go back and forth. We'll probably hit on some of these issues over and over again in different ways. From a police point of view, are there any misconceptions that you see the public holding about domestic violence?
Well, quite often, as Ms. Jenkins touched on, many people really don't understand, why doesn't the victim just leave? And often you'll hear the two of us refer to the victim as being female or she. Mm-hmm. That's due to the fact that a case study from 2003, 85% of domestic abuse victims are female. At one point in time, it was 95%. So those are the statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason a lot of people have a misconception, they think, well, you know, if it was me, I would just leave. Well, it's not that easy. I remember when I was trying to purchase a house, you know, it's almost an act of Congress before you can get everything done and finally get to the, you know, the closing. And even then, you know, that takes all day. Just trying to get an apartment, you know, there's a background check that goes on. You know, they're going to look into your checking account, all those things. And for a mother who possibly has two or three children that's in an abusive relationship to just tell her just to up and leave is very difficult. Something else we also have to remember is that this is an intimate partner. They have intimate knowledge of their friends, their family, who they've already attempted to isolate them from, their church family. So one of the things they do is they threaten family members. Well, I know you're going to your mother's. If you go there, then I'll come there and I'll kill your mother and your father and other family members. They use those things to control this individual, and it frightens them to leave because they don't want to jeopardize anyone else's, you know, well-being.
If I might interject, I think we spoke on that yesterday about 75% of women who leave abusive relationships are killed trying to leave. So we have to make sure that there's a safety plan in place. So that's really an intricate part of the process of leaving. And we have to also remember that her leaving this relationship is not an event. She doesn't just leave. It's a process. It may take 7 to 10 times for her to leave, come back before she has left completely. But in that process, it's important that she is allowed to pretty much just set her own pace as to how she's going to leave, when, and prepare herself with a safety plan.
And actually, Ms. Jenkins, that kind of leads into an email question that we have for you. We have someone that would like to know a little bit more about what are advocacy services. Can you define that for us? Can you give us a little more information about what that consists of?
Sure. I like to think of it like we're just a voice of a survivor, that a survivor may not understand the judicial system or the court system, or at times she may, in fact, be too afraid to come forward. We help with victim impact statements if we want to present that in court. We also have someone who does protective orders, and these services are free. A lot of times she comes to the shelter, she may not have clothes, she may not have ever had a driver's license. We assist with all of those services. We don't do it for her, but all of our services are survivor-led. So I just like to think of it that we're the victim's voice.
Let me back up and ask you about something you said earlier. You talked about 1 in 4 women have had some experience with domestic violence. Is that does that involve like being hit one time, or is it a pattern, or what's contained in that 25%?
Right, I know that, and I've heard different statistics. Actually, I've heard 1 in 3. Here lately, I heard 40%. So the statistics definitely vary, but I do know that. In that number, it entails a vast variety of many forms of violence, including sexual violence towards women.
Sure.
And children.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about real quickly is, tell me again what you meant when you said you were talking about women who leave battering situations, and you mentioned 75%. And did you say that 75% are in danger of losing their lives, or? I just didn't understand what you had said.
Right. Absolutely. Of the number of women who leave, that number, 75% of that number of women who leave are killed trying to leave. So that just pretty much shines a light on the importance of safety planning. And I think Detective Bonner said it best. He knows her friends. He knows where her mother lives. He knows where the children goes to school. And remember, we're talking about a crime of power and control. So once she leaves that relationship, you're looking at an abuser who has completely lost control. So we know that when batterers kill, they have a tendency to kill her, whomever around her, and then even himself.
Again, we ask you, our listeners, if you have comments, questions, criticisms, any kind of input that you'd like to offer, please call in at 1-800 552-8502. I know many of you participated in our previous mental health editions, and we love to have you back. I wanted to ask both of you, put some ideas out here and get your comments on them, if you don't mind. There are some major studies in psychology that have to do with this topic of domestic violence. And one of the major studies talked about five factors in childhood that are sort of precursors and perhaps even predispose, if you will, women for becoming victims and being hurt and so on later in their adult lives. These include if there's battering occurring in the childhood home, sexual abuse or molestation in the home, any kind of experience where there's a lack of control regarding what's happening to them as children, even early loss of parent, separation or death, moving around quickly and without much notice, alcoholism causes a loss of control, health problems where there's sickness. So a child being exposed in his early life or her early life to situations where they lose control or feel out of control seems to be a very negative predisposing factor in child. Do you all have some thoughts and ideas about these various factors?
Sure. Domestic violence is absolutely a learned behavior. But we do believe that learned behavior can, in fact, be unlearned. And we do that through a series of counseling.
Now you're sure. Talking like a psychologist.
So absolutely. Definitely it is a learned behavior. But I will say this, to become a victim of a crime, you're just that, you're a victim. Even if there's a listener out there who is going through this or who may in fact know someone who's going through this, I'd like to say it's not your fault. It's not your fault. You don't choose to be abused. The abuser chooses to abuse you. So it's a safe environment at Project Celebration, and we are definitely there to assist however we can.
Any comments, Sergeant?
Well, children who witness violence at home display emotional and behavioral disturbances as diverse as withdrawal, low self-esteem, nightmares, self-blame, aggressive thought, peers, family members, and property. For 2.5 years, I was a youth service investigator. Many times when abuse is going on in a home from one parent to another, when you have the victim who is in an intimate relationship with the abuser, quite often the abuse spills over to the children. Many of those cases that I worked, there were also reports within our system where once the reports were made by the victim, the adult victim, that they were being abused also by their spouse or significant other. And so it just translates into, you know, continuous and perpetual violence within the entire family home. And those children, they don't develop the same in school because, you know, they're constantly in fear or because they're worried about going home. They're worried about their parents. They have a thought process where that, you know, is beyond where it should be at the ages that they are, especially when you're talking about 3, 4, and 5 year olds. And they're witnessing this perpetual violence, you know, on a daily basis. Sometimes this is their, you know, both parents, you know, they're the biological, you know, child of both parents. Sometimes it's a step parent. Sometimes it's just, you know, a boyfriend that's committing these acts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this behavior, you know, they begin to think, well, this must be normal. There are times when the children, at one point in time, is definitely when they become teenagers, and this situation is still ongoing, they begin to resent the victim because they feel, they begin to think, okay, you're keeping us in this situation because you're choosing this abuser who's continues to jump on you over us, or, you know, so they have a resentment towards it due to that. They don't really understand what the psychological effects of it that's going on with, you know, their mother. And so it's a lot of things, and it can take them in one direction or the other. It can make them decide, I will never be that way. If I get into a relationship, that's the low percentage side of it. or they decide when they get into a relationship, they have no conflict resolution skills. Therefore, when they get into an argument and it gets to the point to where, okay, let's just leave this alone and come back and discuss it later on, they begin to become physical.
Well, the parents are not modeling for them conflict resolution.
Exactly.
So they have no model for that. They're not going to learn that. And if they see a lot of violence, not only are they going to feel helpless, but they're going to be distracted, emotionally upset. They're not going to do as well in school. And they're going to become hypervigilant kids.
Exactly. Right.
You know, always on edge. Go ahead, sir.
And speaking of that, when we say, why does she stay? Just dealing with survivors, a lot of survivors have told me that the reason that she stayed was because of the children.
Sure.
So I think that's a very valid point, that staying because of the children, so to speak, could potentially be raising a batterer.
Yeah.
We have a caller, actually. We have Randy from Shreveport. Go right ahead with your question, Randy.
Yeah, how you doing? This is in reference to a statistic the young lady said a minute ago, that 75% of the people that leave the relationship are killed. I think that the statistic is actually 75% of the people that are, the women that are killed leaving, not that 75% that leave are killed.
Randy was saying that, Randy, say it again, that 75%.
75% of the women that are killed when they're leaving, not 75% of the women that leave are killed.
Correct. That's the better way to, much clearer, better way to state it, because if it were the first way you said it, women would not leave because they, 75% of them would be killed, and that's just not accurate. Thank you so much for saying that so much more clearly. Do you have any other ideas that you want to contribute, Randy?
Well, no. Basically, that it all starts at home, and the cycle needs to be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Men need to step up and be men.
And did you have any thoughts about the idea of children in homes, you know, where children lose a sense of control, and that is a precursor that may contribute to them, you know, falling into this later in their adult lives?
Well, to me, actually, it's how that situation is handled when they do lose control. If children that act out are controlled by physical means in anger situations, that will only reinforce physical responses to anger.
Correct, yeah. Thank you very much for your call.
My pleasure.
I would wanted to raise another issue with both of you. Alcoholism on the part of parents when they are parenting seems to be a precursor that we find in our literature that can contribute to a woman later in life finding herself in a domestic violence situation. Do you have any thoughts about that that finding?
I know in my classes for the recruit training at the academy,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that we talk about is that alcohol in and of itself doesn't cause the abuse. It causes it to escalate, and it enhances what the abuser is going to do. But most often when we make these calls, either one or both parties have been drinking. And, you know, when you're in that type of situation, I believe it's being used somewhat as an escape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start to drink to try to, you know, which alcohol is a depressant. And many times if a person is in this type of relationship and is ongoing, they're depressed or they're feeling down. They have a low self-esteem and they may try to, minimize some of the things that's going on by, you know, taking alcohol or other types of drugs.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, certainly alcoholism in excess lowers inhibition.
Yes.
And reduces judgment.
It does.
And more one's moral fibers in a lot of ways become soluble in a way. Sexual abuse, too, you know, a child who's sexually abused comes to believe that they don't have control over their own bodies and people are misusing them physically And so that certainly is a setup for later on, accepting the fact that someone else can abuse them physically where they lack control. Do you see much of that in your work as an officer?
Not in the unit that I work. We do have a sex crimes unit, and all those type of cases will specifically be there. But, you know, I have worked cases where when I was in youth services, and a lot of times another detective that I worked with closely with at that time, we always would say, you know, with our runaways, they're running away for a reason. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the kids, they're rebelling. But a lot of the kids, they're running away from home because they're running away from something. There's abuse going on. There's some type of sexual abuse. And many times when we would follow up on some of the reports, or when we go back to court and reference something for, you know, juvenile court, those things will come up in relation to maybe the possible physical assault case that we worked. And so we see a lot of those cases, they just intertwine. Like I said before, many of those cases, the parents, one parent is abusing the other, or there's just violence between the two adults. There's another family member that's sexually abusing that child, and that's why that child is running away. I've had a case where one young lady, she just continued to run away, and when we really began to peel away that onion, it was so many layers, and it just ended up running so deep, and we ended up making several arrests, and arrests were made through different units. It was, you know, arrests were made through my unit, which was primarily physical abuse for children, and arrests were made through sexual abuse through the sex crimes unit.
I think we have another call. Is that true, Shelley?
Yes, we do. We have Brad from Alexandria. And Brad, go ahead with your question.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment in reference to the aspect of the children and the situations that they remain in and what they see and how they manifest it later in life. I was fortunate enough that in my upbringing, my father never raised his hands to my mother, and I think it was passed on to us. And I was married twice. My first wife, it was the same situation with her. As she was growing up, her father, again, never raised his hands to his wife, and thus all the children followed those particular examples. Now, after my first divorce, I was involved with two women, and in both cases, one of them was raised in a family that the father had been physically aggressive toward the mother, and it made her, one of three children at least, extremely, physical. Whenever she became angry, she wanted to try and settle it physically. And the other one is another woman. She married a person that I was familiar with the family. I'm former law enforcement, and I was familiar with the family, and I know that there had been that abuse in the family as they were growing, these children. And all the boys manifested it on their particular wives as they grew up as well. So that's all I wanted to say. I was just saying that it does tend to travel, at least in my experience.
Well, Patrina was talking about it being so learned, that it's learned and people are taught this. You were saying that earlier, is that correct?
Right.
And I think that's what you're talking about, is it not, Brad?
Yes, it is. That's exactly it. The boys, their father had routinely abused their mother and was even somewhat proud of it and spoke of it to others at times. And when the boys grew up and got married, they also did. It was almost a mirror image of their father.
Well, you know, when you were saying, Brad, and this may be kind of a controversial idea, but I don't think it was too long ago when a lot of people believed that it was okay to hit one's wife.
That's exactly what he said, the father. He said, you got to knock a woman around occasionally. I thought that was deplorable. And I'm talking as I came of age in the early 80s, you know. I was just raised that, especially in the South, you never hit a woman. If they make you that angry, leave.
Right, but there was a belief that people had for a long time that it was okay to hit women, but it wasn't that long ago that women were property.
Well, that's true. Some do, but I was raised that you do not raise your hands to a woman, And I know many others that were raised that way. And unfortunately, the other does tend to, I don't know which one is more prevalent than the other, but like I said, in my later experience, I seem to run into more that had, I found myself feeling quite fortunate that it had never been inflicted upon me. I don't think I would have done it personally, but who knows what you would have done if you had been exposed to it on a daily basis as this is the way you handle, you know.
Well, I hope that as a society, you know, we're moving more and more away from violence against one another, and certainly against women, against children. And it's, you know, awareness. This is the month for domestic violence awareness, and it's all an attempt to make people aware. And as we become more aware and treat people more properly, hopefully we're evolving as a society. Thank you very much for calling in and spending some time with us.
And I want to invite more listeners to call in at 1-800-552-8502. And I have a quick question. We've focused a lot on women. In y'all's experience, do you come across many men that are domestic violence survivors?
Actually, we do have... several since I've been there, and I've been at Project Celebration probably 4 or 5 months back in the work, and I've personally answered a few crisis calls, but usually we just refer out. We don't house men, and we don't offer services to men, but there are services available.
Do you experience some with the police from a police point perspective?
As far as physical abuse, we don't get many other than a situation that became volatile, they're breaking up, or there was some type of infidelity, that type of situation where it became physical, with the male being struck by the female. But the majority of the time, the type of abuse that we have has with men is more for stalking. We see more of that where it comes to males, where.
So the woman stalking the man?
Yes, through social media, that's a big part of it. Now, I don't do any type of social media, so I don't know all the different names of them, but, you know, Facebook is like the most popular one, and Instagram, some of the other ones that where things are said about the other individual, or they make certain threats towards them in reference to, you know, being a deadbeat father, and, you know, they know people, and they'll send people their way to, you know, do them some type of harm.
And we have a caller. We have Greg from Longview. Greg, go right ahead with your question.
Specifically?
Yes.
With abuse, and specifically with abusers, is there any sort of trends or studies showing that there might be any sort of common psychological problems that these men have?
Well, I can answer somewhat about that, Greg. What I've read in the literature, the psychological literature, is that about 66% of men who hit and abuse women have a paranoid, sort of paranoid personality disorder. These are men that are always looking for clues. They're hypervigilant. They have a lot of unresolved anger from issues in their own life, some of which is abuse of themselves. And in my experience, these men are very very reluctant to get treatment and so on because of their significant distrust of others. Shelley, do you want to chime in on
Greg's
question?
I'm just thinking about antisocial personality disorder, and that's also, you know, we do see that sometimes in batterers, you know, that sort of personality disorder also.
Yeah, so the paranoid personality disorder, the antisocial personality disorder, men who have not inculcated values that are specific to emotional connection and being loved and loving other people and so on, probably because of their learned behavior as well.
And we actually have another caller. We have Hank. Go ahead with your question, Hank.
Yes. Let's say you're a person that's in an abusive situation and you want to separate from that partner. What sort of support can you expect from law enforcement?
Well, Sergeant Bonner, that's a good question.
Okay. With us, if there's been any type of physical abuse, or even if there's been some type of psychological abuse, depending on the history that's there, and no one knows that history better than the two parties that's involved. When I speak of the advocacy information we provide, when somebody calls me, I may not have something criminal that I may possibly be able to charge an offender with. It hadn't reached that level yet. So what we try to do is we refer them to Project Celebration or to the clerk of court's office to try to go and obtain a protective order. And I also explain to them, you know, if you're going to get out of that relationship, you have to have a safety plan in place. You know, get some things together in reference to your finances, where you're going, how you're going to separate yourself from that person. One of the things I tell them to do is, if you have a cell phone, get rid of that one and get another one. There may be different types of applications that, you know, we call them tracking apps that another, you know, a suspect can put on the victim's phone. So these are things that we suggest and, you know, I adamantly try to tell people, you know, get something in place. And I also explain to them that the abuser also has access to the internet, and they read the statistics. They read some of the things that, you know, a person trying to get out of the relationship is trying to do. They're staying ahead of the game. As in sports, you know, they're going to try to, you know, look at film study on the other team, and that's what some of the abusers do. The abusers look to see, and they'll utilize those statistics against the victim. They'll say, well, you know, most women are killed when they try to leave, or they'll print out, the, you know, different stories where women are killed, even here locally, and they'll leave that out for the victim just to try to, you know, to curve their behavior. But the things that we try to do from a law enforcement background is to try to help them to put things in place, so if that person continues in that fashion, that we can have a case that we can possibly build where an arrest can be made. If they violate that protective order, then, you know, if we have enough evidence there and we can develop the probable cause, then we can make an arrest in reference to the violation of that protective order.
Are there any programs that provide phones for survivors of domestic abuse? Or I've also heard of people putting GPS, like trackers on cars. Is there somewhere that someone could get those things checked out?
As far as the cars, you can take them to a mechanic if you have a mechanic that you know, or a shop, and have them, you know, to go over your car, just basically look for something that's not supposed to be there. Because who better knows in reference to the specific vehicle that you're driving, what's supposed to be on it, what, you know, type of computer devices, electronics, because, you know, we drive a computer now. You know, mm-hmm. the entire car in and of itself is a computer. But an expert mechanic is going to know what all is supposed to be on that car and where it's supposed to be. And if something is located, then, you know, contact us, and we'll do some research in reference to that particular item and see if we can't backtrack to where it actually came from.
Good.
If we have time, I want to come back to Hank's question in the Shreveport Police Department. But do we have another caller,
Yes,
Shelley?
We actually do. We have Janice from Shreveport. Go right ahead, Janice.
I have a question. My comment is, I have young adults, and my daughter is 20. And being around that age group, for some reason, they have instilled in themselves that it's okay for your boyfriend to hit you, or it's okay for your boyfriend to misuse you. And I think her upbringing is completely opposite of that, because she was raised in a Christian home where there was never violence or anything like that. But listening to her and her friends, it's really scary to think that we've come so far, yet we're still so far behind. Because these young women allow these young men to sexually abuse them, physically abuse them, mentally abuse them. And how do you break that cycle? It's the music they listen to. It's the people that they're around. And it's very sad, because they often say, well, he loves me. But, you know, love doesn't beat you, or love doesn't lock you in a closet. And then they're too ashamed to come out and talk. I have some of my daughter's friends that are comfortable enough to try. They'll come out and talk to me, and my heart just goes out, because you shouldn't have to do that. At 20 years of age, you have your life ahead of you. And they can't go to the police because they're afraid that the boyfriend will become even more angry and become more aggressive and abusive. So how can we do something? What's in place for these young people? They have nowhere to go, and they've just decided that it's okay.
Well, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they do have certain classes that where it pertains to dating violence. And through CPS, they put on different type of classes and whatnot in reference to that. And in youth services, when I was there, when we had a troubled teen, we tried to address that with that teen and that parent. And as difficult as that is we can only get one at a time. And we as a society, I think we've allowed, you know, certain, I guess you would say, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, where it comes to things as far as television and music, and that those things are what are raising our children. You know, those they're being pulled in so many different directions, and we've become this, you know, as I say, microwave society. Everything is so fast. We have everything instantaneous. In our hands, on all these cell phones, it's a computer. We can pull up whatever information we want to pull up right then and there. And our youth, as great as these things are, you know, it's a double-edged sword. And that's the other side of it. Where we get the bad side of these things is that technology puts them in connection with, you know, people they don't know, you know. How often as children growing up did we say don't talk to strangers, but we get on social media and we talk to people we don't know and actually go meet them. Right. And so they're dangerous situations that, you know, that's pulling them in all these different directions. And our youth, even, and it's almost to the point to where no matter how hard we try, it's difficult because in many situations, both parents are working or it's a single parent home and you're working, you know, extra hours. So the TV has more time with the child than we do. I mean, even though we're providing them with a good environment, a safe environment, we're, you know, have them in church, we're trying to tell them, you know, right from wrong, but the television, the radio, friends, all those things are pulling at that child, and it's difficult for them to try to, you know, stay, you know, on the right path.
Right. Well, in video games, I wasn't aware how violent video games were until just recently, and I was horrified. I mean, maybe it's just I'm old, but I was horrified at how mm-hmm. violent these video games are.
Mm-hmm. And Project Celebration, we do do community education. So we do have someone on staff. So at any point, at any time, we can come out and do domestic violence, dating violence trainings in the community, in any of those seven parishes that we serve, and they're free. So if you have a group of teenagers, you know, maybe a church group or an organization that you want to get together on a Saturday morning, we'd be happy to come out and do a dating violence training. But I'd like to say also that the dialogue right now between yourself and your children is very important, because just like Detective Bonner said, we get so busy and so wrapped up into work that sometimes television, video games are raising our children. And there is, I mean, an enormous amount of objectification of women and girls in video games, in music. We are, just like Detective Bonner said, in an era of instant. So you're getting your live streaming pictures and videos. And as a parent, sometimes it's hard to keep up with that. But I encourage every parent out there, log in, pick up your kid's phone every now and then, find out what messages are they getting about women, about violence. I happen to have two teenage sons, and our conversations are very interesting. Because I get all in their business. I want to know who, what, where, why.
Isn't that called parenting?
It absolutely is. You know, we don't have passwords, and you get a password when you pay your own bill. So I think that kids are just kind of, you know, having so many mixed messages about women and girls and relationships even.
Well, and the research shows that parents are very influential on children. I know that a lot of times we think that peers are more important, but actually parents are a lot more important. What they do, what they say really impacts children. And absolutely. So they, you know, what they do and say does make a difference.
I'd like to kind of weigh in on this. I don't know whether it was Randy or Brad. One of the callers said men need to be men. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important for parents, men, to respect young women and girls and female children and to be involved with them. I've always said I have never met a victim of sexual abuse who had a strong relationship with his or her father. And my hypothesis is that if you have a strong and positive relationship with one's father, whether you're a boy or a girl, you will not be the victim of sexual abuse or battering abuse. But it's got to be involvement and so on. But at the same time, strong female role models, competent, capable women, along with competent, capable, involved fathers who really respect those women, that modeling is so very important in raising children. You know, and of course, on the violence issue, the American Psychological Association 45 years ago came out with strong statements about violence on TV. People who watch, if you watch violence on TV in the comfort of your own home, you don't learn how scary violence really is. If you're out on the street riding with a Shreveport police officer and you see something violent happening, it's frightening. Whereas you're watching violence on TV, you don't have the same emotional learning that occurs if you see real violence. Because violence on TV, you're sitting in a chair, you're in your living room, you're eating popcorn, and the emotional response to TV violence. And so people don't learn properly about what violence is and how negatively impacting it can be on a human being.
And, you know, just like Shelley said, like video games, these kids sometimes are just not fazed. I can remember a couple of Christmases ago, my son asked for Grand Theft mm-hmm. Auto. And so me, you know, I bought it from him, and I'm in my room just typing away, and I hear, I mean, you couldn't imagine.
Oh, I can.
And so he was just sitting there playing it. He wasn't really fazed. And I'm like, do you hear this? And so I think it's just like a common thing to kids. They're not really bothered. So we have to open those doors and find out what's going on with our children.
Thank you very much, callers, Brad, Greg, Hank, Janice. Again, we invite you, our listeners, to call in at 1-800-552-8502. I'm grateful for Randy's call earlier to kind of straighten out and state more clearly what we stated somewhat unclearly. Thank you, Randy, for doing that earlier. So please call in and join us, 1-800-552-8502. Patrina, I wanted to kind of have you comment real quickly on the cycle of violence. I certainly want to say a few things about that, and maybe you do too, Sergeant. Can you say take a minute and just to describe that?
Sure. Our studies are based on something called the power and control wheel, that we're not talking about an isolated instant of violence. We're talking about an actual events that correlate together to form domestic violence. What's interesting about this wheel is that nothing on the wheel is physical. It's all psychological. The first one is intimidation. This person may make you feel intimidated, like by a look even, just a certain look that this individual may have, that you know what that look means, a form of intimidation. Abusing the pets even. We have a program at Project Celebration with the National Humane Society, because in a lot of cases where there's domestic violence, there's also animal abuse. And so she has to come into the shelter, and we have to also find shelter for her animal. So you want to make sure that you're safety planning for yourself as well as your pets or animals.
So to abuse an animal in front of a child or even an adult is, in fact, psychological abuse.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I can remember a victim probably 8 years back. She left, and he called her, and he threatened her, and he said if she didn't come back, he was going to put the cat in the microwave. Mm. And he did just that. Mm. And so she, you know, carried that with her. So this is an individual who's seeing things that we don't see. Mm-hmm. You know, we just think, okay, but she knows the depth of his anger. And that's the importance of allowing the victim or the survivor to set the trend for the amount of treatment or of, you know, safety planning that she's able to do, and not us set that for her. the emotional abuse, the put downs, making her feel bad about herself, calling her names.
So we're talking about the Stockholm syndrome, are we not?
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very, very similar.
It's mind control.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we think that it's just, like you said, power and control. A huge, huge, big one is isolation. The fact that this person has isolated her from friends, family, anyone who could be a support system to her, which is another reason why shelters and mm-hmm. programs are so important, because we do know that batterers know pretty much her every move. So we want to make sure that she's safe. And a lot of times she may not have family to go to. Minimizing, denying, and blaming. And I know Detective Bonner sees a lot of that. A victim may make up reasons as to why this happened, that she possibly did something to provoke him. And even with the Ray Rice situation, we saw it clear as day when Janae stood forth and said, it's the media's fault. She never held him accountable. And somehow she blamed the media and even herself for what had happened. So we see that quite commonly in victims.
What I think about that is when somebody is blaming themselves, they're usually trying to look for a reason that they could have done something different. And that's an effort to avoid the feeling of helplessness, which I think is the worst of all feelings. When a person feels helpless, we really want to avoid that. So if I'm a victim of abuse and I feel helpless, the best way for me to get rid of that feeling of helplessness is to think, well, I must have some part in this, which gives me the illusion of power,
right?
Which just doesn't work.
Well, and I've seen cases where women get out and then they go back and then people say, oh, well, they deserved it because they were out and they were free and clear and they went back. They chose to go back. Well, explain that to us. Help us understand that.
Right. And I think I've, heard that many times before. But talking with survivors, women have said to me, it was safer for me to stay. And I know that sounds almost, just completely unreasonable to us, but women have said it was safer for her to stay, that by staying, she was keeping her family safe or she was keeping her children safe. And sometimes that's actually the case, that a woman has heard him say, if you leave, I'll kill your mother. Or if you leave, I'll go to your job and I'll kill your boss. And so her staying sometimes is ultimate survival tactic.
One of the things that I wanted to point out real quickly, we're talking about the cycle of violence, and I think there are three phases to this cycle of violence. One is a tension-building phase. The second is an acute explosive incident where someone is battering. And the third is sort of the loving contrition phase. And so I sort of see it on a graph, tension builds, and then there's a violent explosion. And then following that, there's contrition, which I see as positive reinforcement for the violent act. And so the act of violence or the act of striking out and hurting someone else is then reinforced by contrition. I'm sorry, the devil made me do it. I'll never do it again. I love you dearly. I don't know what got into me. And that is certainly what the victim wants to hear. But it's just after that explosion, which is learning.
Abuser is very controlling and manipulative. And, like I stated before when we first started, when the relationship began, they swept this person off their feet. And they'll reveal something about their background, something that happened in their life that is very profound, and it makes the victim feel like, wow, for them to tell me that, that I must really mean a lot to them.
Correct.
And it really draws that victim in, and they become so intertwined with this other individual, and they really don't know all about them yet because they're painting such a beautiful picture of themselves, and love becomes a big part of this. We keep, a lot of times we look at just the physical side of it. Why is she stand in this relationship, you know, that isn't love with this person beating on you, but it started that way.
Well,
it started
with
love, and they think that's what it is. And maybe if I do this as the victim, maybe it's my fault. I can get him to be the person that I know he really is, you know, the person that I fell in love with. If I can just stop doing what I'm doing, if I can, you know, help, you know, if I don't make, you know, dinner wrong, or if I don't burn something, if I put on my makeup, or if I don't put on any makeup, I did something that made him, you know, so angry. And then when we get back to the honeymoon phase, he sweeps her off her feet.
So it sounds like, you know, in sexual abuse, we see a lot of grooming that goes on. It sounds like that there's grooming that goes on with domestic violence also.
And then also you'll, by chance, sometimes see a victim who'll say, yeah, I hit him first. I hit him. I did. I went ahead and started it because she's, in fact, wanting to hurry up, get it over so we can get to the honeymoon phase.
See, I think in that incident, what I would see that as the tension is building so much that she goes ahead and hits him to reduce the tension.
Absolutely.
To get it over with and to get to the reward of, oh, I'm sorry I did that, which is what she wants to hear.
Absolutely.
So a lot of times people are critical of women saying that they start it. And I don't think that's the way to see that at all. I think it's tension. It's tension breaking. It's on. Listeners, if you would like to call in again, 1-800, I guess Shelley's kind of telling me we're running out of
time. Sorry.
I'm sorry, I got absorbed. I got absorbed in this.
They can call next time.
Okay. I guess I want to thank you both for being here. Sergeant Bonner from the Shreveport Police Department, the Domestic Violence Abuse Division, and Patrina Jenkins, thank you. And thank you very much, Randy and Brad, Greg, Hank, and Janice, for calling in and joining us. We very much appreciate your participation.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, you should consult a mental health professional or physician. This show is available for download, or you may listen to a podcast of this program on our website, redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided this evening by Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. Support of this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Shelley Visconti, along with Dr. Mark Vegan. Thank you and good night.